the guru will teach the student whatever he requires the most. The guru will understand the journey of a student, which direction this student can go, which direction he will progress better.
Hi, you're listening to Conversations with Musicians with Leah Roseman. In this week's episode, I'm delighted to feature the master bansuri player Milind Date, who joined me from his home in Pune, India, and played his flutes as well as shared his perspectives from his life in music. As always, check the timestamps for both the music and the many topics we covered. Milind spoke to me about his studies with the legendary Pandit Hari Prasad Chaurasia, of his fusion projects, especially in South Korea. He had a great story about a memorable concert he played in Toronto, his extensive travels in India and internationally. He has a large and varied discography and has composed music for many films. Check out his link in the description. So hello, Milind. Thanks so much for joining me today.
Hi, Leah, and thank you very much. Namaste, everybody, and thank you, Leah, for inviting me on this your show. It's really, really a fantastic show. I mean, I'm looking forward for it.
So some of my listeners may never have heard a bansuri flute. So I thought it might be nice, actually, if you're willing to share some music, maybe one of the rags that you've written, you could improvise on one of those and speak to that.
Yeah, sure.
So what happens is, like, because we have this, we don't have these keys to the flute, it is quite difficult to play chromatic scales. This speed is manageable, but it doesn't sound good. But if we are playing a rag, essentially it is a scale. So we just have practiced and we can manage. So almost, I mean, except this note, all holes are closed or open were half. But somehow in that context, it is manageable. But somehow it is very difficult to, at least for me, to play chromatic progressions on bansuri flute. But as I said, this slurs. It's very, very Indian style of singing. It is very easy. Very, very easy means like you can play it. It's not so easy either, but you can manage it. It's not like, well, nothing is easy in front of me.
So I know that you've written quite a few of your own ragas.
Okay.
Could you improvise on one of them for
us? Yeah, sure. This rag is called as Sunandas Bhairav. It is one of those Bhairav melodies which are played in the morning. And this is, I have named it as Sunanda Bhairav.
Mm-hmm. Beautiful. So when you went to study with your guru, Hari Prasad Chaurasia, I'm just curious about the type of music you were listening to, because shortly after you started playing, you also started doing fusion music, which you do to this day. So were you listening to rock music and jazz and stuff as well as
traditional music? I grew up with a lot of long-haired guitar players in my college. In India, college means after 10 years of education. The next 2 years we call it junior college, and then next 3 or 4 years we call it as college. I think in America it's called as high school. I'm not too sure. So that time we had quite a few guys who were playing rock, and they were into very, very like classic rock, and I started liking it. That age is like that rock music is, it's music of freedom and rebellion. So I started liking Deep Purple and Scorpions and all that kind of things. But honestly, to be honest, I could never go ahead of GNR or Metallica. Guns N' Roses and Metallica, after that, I don't know. I mean, I have not enjoyed too much of rock music after that. I still find myself engrossed in Dire Straits and Deep Purple and all. I mean, that very, very classic rock 70s, 80s era. That generally I prefer. So what happened was I started playing with these guys in college, and then naturally we started playing some things together. And of course, these guys being Indian, they had heard a lot of Indian music anyway. So we found some common ground and started working on that. The interesting part was that even though we were playing cover songs, more or less, I could not play the guitar solos beyond a point. So I started improvising on those scales, and improvising is something in the basic nature of Indian classical student. Because 99% what we do on stage is improvise. Like few guys, there are several musicians who have like kind of remembered everything, and then they come on stage and perform exactly like that. But there are very few. And that even in that, there's a lot of scope for improvisation. The structure remains same, but the internal lines come out differently every time. They'll come out differently. So that entire improvisation thing happened. And that's how I got into the fusion or world music. So it kind of went parallel. Like one side I was learning pure classical music. I was playing a lot of Hindi film songs and all that. I mean, I was accompanying some of the best singers. And on a college level, I was playing a lot with. And there used to be like, you know how college kids are, that they have lots of time on their hand. We were never like focused right from. There are some children who are like very focused. They will study 8 hours a day and all that. I was never like that. So we had a lot of time on our hands. So we would jam up, and that there would be long listening sessions. Like we would get together in some friend's place, and he would put on some music and, hey, just play that. And, hey, see, I heard this song new, and somebody where I got cassette. That was the era of cassettes. Not even CDs were also not there. So all these mixtapes and bootlegs and all that kind of, somebody must have got some from somewhere, and we would listen to some Simon and Garfunkel from Gill and all that, like, you know, that classic era, right from Beatles, everything. It's lovely.
Yeah, we're around the same age. I grew up listening to some of that as well. But your guru, he actually played with George Harrison. He is on a Beatles album.
I think the White Album. I think they played on the White Album. That's what they composed in Rishikesh, if I'm not wrong.
Did he encourage you to play other styles of music, or did he know about it when you were starting with
him? He knew. He never really restricted me from playing anything. See, my Guruji has also played in variety of genres, not just pure Indian classical music. He has played innumerable recordings, like tens of thousands of recordings for Bollywood. I mean, now we call it Bollywood, but that time it was just film music. And he has worked with the best of the best. Yes, played a lot of concerts with, right from John McLaughlin to Jan Garbarek or Jethro Tull, Jan Anderson, and of course the Beatles and George Harrison. So he has that kind of exposure also. Being instrumentalist, we don't need the word. We are not restricted with the word. So the moment you get into improvisation world, a lot of things open up by the nature of it.
Mm-hmm.
So there, you always I have played a lot with Korean musicians and Japanese musicians and all that. So hardly anybody could speak English, but musically we were always happy because we could always find some common denominator, some common ground to walk on, and then just play. So I think he never stopped me from doing practically any type of music.
Yeah, I was curious about your collaborations with Korean musicians, because you've toured there a lot, you've released lots of albums. Yeah. So how did that get started?
Oh, that is a very funny story. I mean, one day I got a call from a local singer, and she said that there is some troupe of Korean musicians coming to Pune, and they're interested in doing some fusion work here, recording some stuff. Would you be interested? There is not much money, but would you be interested? I said, not much money is a kind of common story for all musicians in the world, I think. So I said, not a problem. I'll learn something. I'll enjoy something. So there were four or five Korean guys, musicians, and one guy who was a manager who could speak some English. I, Milin, you, Leah, that kind of English. So rest of them, none of them could speak English. And then eventually he invited me once, and I remember when he invited me for the first time, the day I landed, my flight was at some weird time. I had some weird lag over in Singapore. I God knows why I went with that flight. But I had to stop over for 8 hours direct flight. I had 12 hours of break on Singapore Airlines.
Oh.
And of course, I couldn't sleep. So when I reached Korea, it was afternoon, already in afternoon. And then he directly took me. My main program was one of the main programs was the next day. So directly took me to some cafe. There were some musicians playing blues, jazz blues, that kind of thing. And he directly put me on the stage and, play. And that was interesting. And those guys were also quite nice, actually. They were pretty good. I don't know who they were. They were Americans, that's for sure. They were not local Korean guys, but one was playing bass, one was playing guitar and singing, one pianist and a drummer. So they had that kind of quartet. I just jumped on the stage and improvised whatever I could. I improvised. And this guy kind of loved it. So immediately started calling everybody and his friends. And I had basically two concerts or three concerts lined up. So in the next 15 days, I must have played 20 concerts.
Wow.
And since then, I went to Korea 15 times, probably more. And it was fun.
Mm-hmm. What do you like about visiting there in terms of the culture or the way
I'll tell you
done?
What I don't like. I don't like the food. Because I'm a vegetarian and it's very difficult.
Yeah.
And because of language, nobody speaks English there. Now it's better, but initially, when I went, first time I went there was in 2002, so nobody really spoke English. It was very difficult to tell those people that, no animal parts, no animal parts, no fish, no fish. Mm-hmm. But what I love about Korea, there are many, many things. One of the most important things, I think, Korean people, audience, as well as the musicians, are looking forward for something different, something new. They are very much receptive to some new sound, new technique, new ideas, new line of thinking. Of course, you have to be within the framework somewhere. That guiding, binding framework has to be there. Otherwise, you're playing minor and I they start playing major, it's just because it is different, it's not going to sound good. So they are very open. Also, there are certain, being Eastern, there are several common like line of thinking, I would say. Common lines of thinking that the Indian music also will think in this particular direction in general. The same thing is with mm-hmm. Korean musicians. They will also they will think in a similar direction. The fundamental of thinking is similar. That way, Western music and Indian music, especially the music I follow, Indian classical, I learned Indian classical music, the fundamentals are quite different actually. What we play is more from the improvisation side. And if you actually think, notice that improvisation is a pretty much small part in the Western music world. Basically, some progressive rock or some rock guys and almost everybody in blues are the only people who are improvising. Pop, classical, reggae, maybe reggae guys will improvise a bit of solos and all that. But they're not much into improvisation. At least that's what I gather. Maybe I'm wrong. But
I mean, there's different traditions in Europe that are very improvisatory.
Oh, okay.
And you forgot to mention jazz. Of course,
jazz. Of course, jazz is there.
Yeah.
But in India, the entire world of Indian classical music is fundamentally improvised, like jazz. Basically, it's like mm-hmm. it's completely improvised. But beyond that, I think somehow I've managed to find a lot of common ground to talk in the sense like talk with my flute, you can say, with Korean musicians. So I enjoyed there. I mean, there are also a lot of musicians there who are ready to take chance, ready to take risk, being on the stage and just one or two rehearsals, we just find some kind of landing points, resting points, and then okay, you play after that, I'll play after that kind of thing, and then let's see what will happen on stage. That was the interesting part, that they were there were a lot of musicians who were ready to take that risk of being on stage mm-hmm. without much of preparation and just go by your sixth sense and kind of thing. So that was amazing. That was really amazing. That's still really good.
So you've toured a lot, but when we had the pandemic shutdowns in 2021, you decided to go on a big solo trip.
Yeah.
Just for fun. Yeah. So I know you have lots of beautiful photos and stories. People should read your blog, but could you share some of that experience with us?
Oh yeah, sure. What happened was, well, it's a very long story. It's a 6 months long story, but how it started was a very funny thing. Just behind my house, there was some construction going on. Once that entire pandemic kind of first wave went out, they had stopped working on that pandemic. Once the restrictions were lifted off, they had almost finished that construction building and they almost had made it ready and the pandemic started. So after 3-4 months, again, they started, but that was not much work left. And then they would, the everyday trucks would come and pick up all the, whatever they have created, whatever unwanted construction part, they would dump in the truck and go away. In that, that was December of 2020. And I started coughing a lot and no matter how many medicines I took, no matter what I did, all sorts of pathies, allopathy, homeopathy, Ayurveda, and this and that, that cough was not stopping. Suddenly, one guy told me, "Arey, you should keep the window shut because there's a lot of very fine dust getting, spread in the air because mm-hmm. when they dump it in the truck, they are dumping it from the top and it just falls down, and it just, you know, that all these finest part of dust and cement, they get spread, they get in the air, start floating in the air. And then I realized it was a mechanical problem, because I was breathing that entire fine dust every moment. And obviously, no matter, I mean, it's like a mechanical problem, no matter how many chemicals I took under the name of medicines, that was not going to help. So I decided, let me go to some seashore, which is not too far from here. And because seashore in India is like very humid and very warm, basically. So it's like taking steam every moment. Cold steam, because it's very humid. So I said, okay, and then I packed up my bag and I took out my car and went to Goa. I started with the idea that I'll go there for a week and come back. Once I, like, you know, this coughing is gone, come back. The coughing went away within one day. So by the time I reached Goa, it was like, it's like 8 hours from here. I was okay. Then I had seen some pictures of a very lovely Lord Shiva statue, and just on the seashore, kind of a little uphill, and there is this big statue, and just in front of that there is a very tall temple. So that somewhere I saw it on the internet, and then I realized it's like only 4 hours from 4 hours from where I was staying. So I had my own car, so I said, okay, let me just go and try over there, see and come back. So I liked the place, and then somebody told me, there is some nice place to watch nearby. And then I never came back to Goa. I just kept going ahead. And I came back to Pune after 2 months. I moved around all in the South India. Then I came back. I came to Pune, my home, just picked up a bigger box, a bigger bag, and took some more clothes and all that, and started traveling north, and came back home after directly 6 months. So it was fun. I mean, I had a very lovely experience. What happened was, I was driving solo. So initially I booked some hotels and all that. Then I realized, why, I don't even need to book a hotel. I just walk in, and that way I'm getting the cheapest rates. Because I go to some hotel at 7 in the evening, or 6 in the evening. Do you have a room? And I just want to, like, you know, sleep in and leave in the morning. So they know that there are how many rooms are free, and how many they can, guests they can, clients they can, customers they can expect. So I would get the cheapest rates also. So it was fun. So I went to, first in January 2021, I went to Goa, then I went to Karnataka, then I went to Tamil Nadu, then I went to Pondicherry, then came back, then I went to Gujarat, Rajasthan, Punjab, then I went to Himachal, via Himachal Delhi, I went to eventually Uttarakhand, then I stayed for 1 month in Uttarakhand. I went up to Nepal border, all up in the mountains and all that. I love mountains. I'm a very, very mountain guy. I'm not much of a sea guy. I'm a very mountain guy. So I was very happy. And then from there, I came to Himachal Pradesh. I stayed in Himachal for 1 month. Then I went to Kashmir. And via Kashmir, I went to Ladakh. In Ladakh, I again stayed for 1 month. And then one day, I got bored. So okay, I said, let's go home. And I started driving 5th day I was at home. It's like 5 day drive anyway. Mm-hmm. So it was fun. I got in contact with a lot of local musicians. I got to learn a lot of music, local folk music from them. And I composed a lot of music sitting there. I practiced a lot. So it was fun. It was all in all, I just loved it. I would love to do it again, but not this year. Maybe next year.
Yeah. So you were able to do this because concerts were
absolutely
shut down at that time.
I had nothing to do. But even anyway, I mean, I still can do it. If I get a concert, I'll just park my car at an airport. I'll go out and come back and continue.
Yeah. Yeah. Would you remember one of the folk tunes you learned on that trip that you could play for us?
Yeah, of course. So this is a folk tune from Uttarakhand region of India, which is a northern Himalayan state. Actually, I was kind of lucky. I was there in a place called as Sangla. I was driving and suddenly I saw a group of bunch of people all dressed up in their traditional outfits. So I can clearly that was a marriage party. So they were they were going, there was a either boys side or the girls side. So I caught them and I said, like, can I take your pictures? So they were more than happy. So I took some pictures and then eventually I attended that wedding also. And that was fun. So this is one of those, probably it's a like, you know, marriage songs or something. This is not the exact marriage song I'm going to play, but these are, I would say that these are the impressions from what I heard in that. So it will be very close to that, but not exact.
Hi, just a quick break from the episode. I'm an independent podcaster who does all the many jobs required to produce the series, and there are a lot of costs I bear as well. Please consider either buying me a virtual coffee as a tip or becoming a monthly supporter starting at $3 Canadian, which is close to $2 US or 2 euros, and getting access to unique perks. The link is in the description. Now, back to the episode.
Oh, thank you.
So beautiful.
Thank you. These folk melodies are lovely. in India, so you can always think of India as a little smaller Europe. Like Europe has completely different cultures, like Spanish culture is completely different than German or French, or all they are like different cultures, different languages. So similarly, in India also, there are completely different cultures in South and North and East and Center. So almost all regions, the big parts of the country, they have their own traditional music, folk music. And that can be drastically different from each other. So this particular part is Pahadi or folk. Pahad means mountains. So Pahadi is something from Pahad. So Pahadi can be dress, Pahadi can be a person also, or Pahadi can be a language, or Pahadi can be a food. Whatever happens in mountains, from the mountains. So this is music is Pahadi. Mm-hmm. But in this trip, I learned that the Pahadi's tune melody in India is very, very popular, especially in South, till Maharashtra, it's very popular. My Guruji has played it in probably almost every concert. He must have ended by Pahadi, because so at the end of the concert, he would ask the people, okay, what should I play now? Pahadi, because he was known for that. But in this trip, because I stayed there for a month and I interacted with a lot of local people, I learned that Pahadi also is different. Like Uttarakhanda Pahadi is quite different than Himachal Pahadi, which is very, very different than Kashmir Pahadi, and then that Baltistan area, that Pahadi is again little different. So that was actually a good education for me. And I got it kind of firsthand from the creators.
Do you have one main flute you play, but other flutes you have as well?
I have my practice, and my pure classical is necessarily on the flute, is in the key of E. When I say a flute which in the key of anything, that means the top three holes close, whatever that note will be produced, that is the key of the flute according to me. So this is F. This one is smaller one. So this is G, and this is even the smaller one. That is when I close these three holes, the note sound that sounds is D. So for my classical, I have a E flute, concert flute, and I have a several five, six, seven different flutes. And all other flutes are there. The harmonica, the mouth organ, we have entire set. One flute matching with every key on the piano. Two octaves, otherwise the flute will be too big or too small to play. Too big, I can't even spread my fingers. Mm-hmm. So the biggest flute I have is A. It's pretty big. And the smallest I have is, I think, E. It's like this one, 8 inches or something.
Okay.
So, because as I said, one of the reasons why we also need that is that there are no keys to the flute. So, if the song is in F, and if I have to play it on a flute of E, it is going to be a nightmare opening all the half notes.
Yeah.
So, I might have just put the flute, E flute away, okay, so you take rest, I'll pick F flute and start playing. That was good. In all probabilities, if you're playing for some songs and all that, in all probabilities, if the song is in F minor, then I'm not going to take F flute. I'll take some other flute. Or if, say, for example, it is in E minor, I'm not going to pick up E flute. I'll probably play take a G flute or a D flute. So I get that half notes become full open holes. So it's just a kind of. Mm-hmm. just that's all open whole circuit, so sounding yeah. better.
If we could go back to traditional Hindustani music, so I did. You're the first Hindustani musician
oh, really?
I've had on the series.
Okay.
There will be more, but
okay.
I also, yeah, I did interview a Carnatic violinist who lives near Toronto. So there was a split, right, in Indian classical music, maybe like the from Carnatic that the Hindustani became different, maybe in 1200 or something. And it is aligned with Arabic Persian music principles, right? Like the way they think of the scales and improvisation.
I'm not too sure about that. Undoubtedly, the Hindustani, that is the North Indian music, is more influenced with the scales coming from the outside of Indian subcontinent, maybe from Persia or somewhere else. But the fundamental difference is not that. The fundamental difference in Carnatic music, that is South Indian music, and North Indian music is in thinking. It's not, and of course, then the style.
Mm-hmm.
So the Carnatic musician, I mean, he'll very like whereas in the North Indian guys will play more steady notes, more longer notes, more steady notes. So Carnatic musician, so, that kind of style is way much more prevalent in South India than the North Indian. North Indian style is much more deeper, much more slower. At least initially, of course, we also play very fast music. It's not that we don't play fast, but that the way, how should I tell you? In Indian, we would say "aavaj lagane ka tarika alag hota." It means like, okay, I'll sing and tell you. Some guys, even in North India, say for example, some gharanas, they will say, very heavy, powerful type of, my voice is not like that, but at least like very heavy, powerful voice they have. But some gharanas, they will have, so more lighter type, more ornaments and all that. So that way the styling of North and South is very, very different. Very, very different. Now South Indian music still is like much, much, much more rhythm oriented, mathematics oriented, calculation oriented than the North Indian. That's clear.
Mm-hmm. So each gharana was like a school is the style.
Correct.
That the guru passes down. And the way traditional music is studied is so different than what we're used to in the West. It's your guru is much more than a teacher. So could you speak to the experience when you first went to study with Hari Prasad Chaurasia?
Okay. It's it's of course the day I will never forget in my life. Different gharanas. So in Indian classical music, like many other traditional art forms, like yoga or asana or spirituality or medicine, Indian medicine like Ayurveda, all these systems which have evolved over the period of 1,000 years, 2,000 years, I don't know how many, but quite a long time of period, they all have their own gharanas. Because, see, in terms of music, there is one teacher and he has, say, for example, three or four phenomenal, the best of his students who themselves are like, you know, on to becoming very good performers or artists themselves. But what happens is, either deliberately or just by the virtue of the fact that every person is different, Somebody will like red color, somebody will like green color, and so on. So one of the students starts thinking that he is better in doing that. So he gives more focus on the mathematics or the rhythm part of it. One guy says that I like the very deep and meditative nature of the music, and he will focus on it. The third guy will say, both are good, so I will play some balanced music. Initially, I will play some very deep, very soft, and then I will get into the rhythmic aspect of it. And the fourth person is like, he is good in all, but he would say that I would, this is too serious for me. I want to make it slightly easy to digest music. So the one guru has produced three students or four students which are thinking differently. And that is encouraged. Mm-hmm. The reason is that otherwise you will become a Xerox copy of your guru. And there are examples. There are examples in India that, this guy plays exactly like his guru. And if he continues, then he is actually kind of frowned upon that, he only plays like his guru. Yeah, then why not we will just listen to his guru? Why should we go to listening to him? So everybody at certain point is kind of forced to decide what direction he is getting into. And that's how the gharanas are born. Now, if somebody becomes one of, like, all these three students become very, very successful, very, very, like, you know, creative and really great. But one is like in rhythm section, more rhythmic aspect of presentation. One is he's like focusing more on the deep nature. So the same gharana will have completely two different presentation ways. And then eventually, down the line, in all probabilities, this guy will move to some different town, this guy will move to different town, and their style of performance will be known as the gharana from that town, because most of the gharanas in India are named after the towns. So that's what happens. So when I started learning with Guruji, I had already studied for 1.5 years with my first guru, Pandit Ajit Soman, here in Pune. And he was also an incredible teacher. So within 1.5 years, he kind of prepared me so well that when I went to Hariji, I was not immediately asked to leave. Hey, kya, what's nonsense you are doing? Please go away. And that didn't happen. So somehow he accepted me. And his way of teaching was he would sit and we would follow him. He was not too much vocal about explaining things. So a lot of things were left to us to find out. So if we had a question, we were probably encouraged to find out on our own first. And in case if we still can't find, then ask some senior student of his. That is, I just have two senior students, really speaking, Rakesh Chaurasia and Rupak Kulkarni. We studied together a lot. And if still we can't find, then ask Guruji. But because that was the era before internet, so answers were not very easy to find. So I had to find ways to get the right answer. So in that process, I also learned to understand how to eliminate a lot of answers which may sound correct but not the 100% correct one. So that process was very interesting. So that's why I was kind of encouraged, I would say, or I was taught to think and decipher between things which are kind of open to interpretation. Because unlike Western classical music, here there is nothing written. Hari Prasad ji has not even given me one syllable like sa or re or whatever written. Like, okay, take down this. Nothing. Never. Whenever I teach my students, I don't teach anything. I don't give them anything in writing. I discourage them from writing. If I'm teaching something, then I might say, okay, you just record this. Just for 1 week, you just practice and just forget it because you'll get it.
Yes, Milind, I was just curious what questions you were asking when you said you'd have questions and you'd go to his other students. I was just curious what sort of things.
A lot of times they were about rag. Tell me how this rag goes. I do even today.
Okay.
That I will ask Rupak, okay, how is this rag? Like, for example, rag Bhim Palas. So it's in reality a mixture of rag Bhim and Palas. So how does that work? Or sometimes I heard some concert somewhere and I didn't understand something. So then probably I would go to that artist and ask him that you did this kind of structure, I didn't understand this. So then he would explain me. So
okay.
Mm-hmm. All these kind of things, or some tihais or something I saw somewhere, then I saw that, it was very nice. Then he would either explain me or ask me, why do you want to do that? His instrument is different in nature, flute is different in nature.
Mm-hmm.
So basically, I would say that my very fundamentals were getting cleared. Like, you know what happens is like, mm-hmm. I don't know how it is about Western classical, it must be like there. It's a human nature, I think, that once you start learning something and you reach up to a point where you can actually play quite good, you can easily replicate anything you are, like, you know, you are hearing. You hear any part of music and you at least like 80% you can immediately replicate. You understand what that notes are and all that. You know, then comes a time that there are different types of music or different styles that starts attracting you, because at one point you probably think that, okay, I can pretty comfortably do whatever I want, but I cannot play that because you have never studied that. Mm-hmm. You are not going to be able to play something which you have, you know, not studied. It's very difficult. Then that starts attracting you and you start going behind that. But then why it is not played in our style? There has to be some answer. So these kind of things, okay, why don't we play this? Why don't we do this? I saw somebody doing this, but we never play that. Why is that? Or somebody did something, okay, but they did it like this. We do it differently. What is the reason behind that? So sometimes technical, sometimes musical, sometimes philosophical, those kind of questions. There are basically four major movements in Indian classical music. Again, there are two basic styles of Indian classical music. One is called as Dhrupad and one is called as Khayal. So Dhrupad is the older one. It's like 600, 700 years old. Whereas Khayal is about 300 years old. Around maybe 4, I don't know. Maybe 1500, 1600 started. Maybe 4, 5, 600 years. And Dhrupad is much more. Like 800, 900, I don't know. It's pretty ancient. So what we do is like we start off with the Dhrupad style, which is the ancient, very slow, very deep, very meditative. And then eventually we mix up the styling from the Khayal style. So I asked my Guruji once, because I saw one sitar player doing one particular patch in that one second movement of the rag, which we call as jol. And then I asked that he was playing in exactly 4-4-4-4-4-4 segments. But we don't do that. Why is that so? So there could be many answers, but one of the answers is you want to play the jol in a particular time frame, then why not start the tabla? Just get a support from tabla for that particular time. So it's a question of difference of thinking. Like he thinks differently, we think differently, I think differently, he thinks. Mm-hmm. So those kind of questions I would ask Guruji. A couple of months ago, he had come to Pune and we were talking for almost three and a half hours. I was asking him. And then as the discussion went ahead, different topics came up. It was nice.
So I think it was 1989 when you started studying with him. Did you live in his house?
No. Well, yes and no. In the sense, like, I didn't go and live in his house permanently or for a longer duration. I stayed overnight at his place several times. But nowadays, it's very difficult to actually go to a guru's place and live there for practical reasons. But now, my Guruji has his own academy at Vrindavan Ashram, Gurukul. So he has 5 or 6 students staying there with him. He keeps this same student for 3 or 4 years, and then they go out, newer ones come. But yeah, I mean, I stayed here and he's not like packed up my bag and shifted there, not that way.
Well, yeah, I was just curious because I knew sometimes that was the case. And with him, you weren't expected to help with the household. It was just learning. But sometimes there is that kind of relationship with some gurus.
There is actually a very interesting story about that. Very first time I went there, I, of course, started going from that day. And it was his birthday. It was July 1989. And the next, it was a Sunday. And next, I think it was a Sunday. Next Sunday when I went, I reached early because I went from Pune. So I took the first train out and I reached there like half an hour early. I reached his place. So his wife asked me, will you drink tea? I said, like, yeah, I will drink that. I was in college that time. I was just in college. So I had also heard a lot of stories that once you are learning at a guru's place, you have to do a lot of chores, a lot of work. Right from getting water from the well and all the ancient stories. Now that water comes from tap, but still, a lot of work tasks, household tasks we have to do and help him in his day-to-day routine and all that. So I drank the tea and got up and started towards the kitchen, which was a smaller kitchen, was just next door. And basically, I just wanted to wash and keep the saucer and cup inside. So the Maji, his wife, was sitting there. He asked me, where are you going? I said, like, I'm going inside. Why? So I said, like, I want to wash it. So she called one of her servants and, okay, take the cup away. And that servant came and took the cup away. And he asked me with a like very stern face, why do you come here? I was like, I didn't understand. It was my second day at his place and I just put my head down and I didn't speak a word. So she again asked, why do you come here? So I said, like, to learn flute. So he said, like, go there. She said, go there and practice. There are 4 servants in our house to do all these works. You're not coming here for that. You're coming here for learning. Go and practice. So she was like very clear about this, that no, there are enough, old days are old days, now it's just the situations have changed. So no, actually we helped, but not in the house chores and all that. He would tell give us some tasks here and there once in a blue moon.
And you would work many, many hours at that time? Practicing and learning
work in the sense
yeah
oh yeah I mean Maximum I think I have played was about 20 hours in one day.
How is that possible?
I just pick up the flute and keep playing. Around somewhere between 19 to 20 hours I played that day. Because I couldn't play something, and I was very irritated with the fact that I can't play that. So I wanted to play, so I played. So once I got it, then the next 6-8 hours was like actual practicing. Because you know how it is. You have one piece and you play it and you can't play it, and suddenly you can play it, but that's not even the beginning. It's before the beginning. You have to play it 100 times and maybe you play it without mistake. That age is like that. That what else I had to do in my life? Nothing. And you are like, whatever, I mean, 18, 20, nothing has to do with your life.
And so there's another great musician who I know has been a mentor to you, the tabla player, Zakir Hussain.
Well, I didn't play with him in his productions and all, but whenever he accompanied my Guruji, I have played numerous times with my Guruji and him. But I have never performed with him in his productions and his own setups. But he has been another guru to me. He has been a great mentor to me. And I have a fortune to, again, the same way, ask him a lot of questions, different occasions. And then he would cross-question me, why are you... Once I remember, very clearly I remember, I was in... he was performing with Shiv Kumar Sharma in... Lafayette, one of the Purdue University's towns in either Indiana or one of those places, I don't remember. So I had gone there and I told him that, Zakir bhai, these days I'm playing one piece in 8.5 beats, 9.5 beats, and 10.5 beats. I generally discuss with my tabla player who is playing. If he's okay with it, then I'll play. So he asked me, why are you doing that? So I said, basically you and Guruji have done so much in Indian classical music, and on the flute especially, that there is nothing much left for us to do something slightly different than, otherwise I'll become a copycat of Guruji. So then he thought for a second, he said, yeah, it's also correct. Do it good, do it well. I said, yeah, I'm trying. I mean, such kind of, like, there are a lot of things which I got to learn from him. Musical, non-musical, behavioral, all sorts of things. I mean, that way I've been actually quite fortunate. I mean, I am a student of Pandit Hariprasad Chaurasia. It was actually a kind of walk-in for me to many, many great masters like Pandit Shiv Kumar Sharma, or Pandit Jasraj Ji, or Pandit Ustad Sultan Khan Sahib, or Zakir Bhai, Bhim Singh Ji, or many, many artists. I could go and ask questions, a lot of questions to a lot of these masters. Mm-hmm. In all sorts of, like, maybe I would hear one of his recordings and can you tell me something more about this composition, this way, how you tackle it. So it's more of, because it's like very, the entire thing is, nothing is written, right? The tradition is very, very oral transfer of knowledge. Mm-hmm. So that was it. So I was very lucky. I was really, really lucky. So I could ask Hridayanath Mangeshkarji, who is a big, very, very important composer in the songs, Marathi and Hindi songs. And he's the brother of these two genius, greatest singers, Lata Mangeshkar and Asha Bhosle. So I could ask Asha Taye also. I could Usha Taye. I could ask if I come, something comes to him, okay, Ashata, you sang it that way. What? Why this? Why not this? That kind of thing. So these kind of interactions clear the direction, because Otherwise, like, you know, in Western classical, almost everything is written. So there is already a fundamental guideline. There's already a fundamental guideline that if there is, like, okay, there are three Fs, so you have to play it loud. Or if there is like a P, then you have to play it slightly soft. That already some kind of guidelines are there. A lot of parts are open to interpretation by the conductor. But in Indian classical music, everything is left to us.
Yeah.
There are no guidelines. We create the guidelines. Mm-hmm. Today I feel like this and I'm going to do this, play like this. So the same rag I can, any good musician for that matter, can play in a completely different way. One day it will sound very energetic, very upfront, very powerful. Another day, it will have much more subdued version of that same rag. It can be, and then you can see it on, you can check it on YouTube. I mean, the same rag, you just search Ahir Bhairo and you'll find very fast compositions and very slow compositions, all depending on the rag also and depending on the performance. So these things really work. Mm-hmm.
So you mentioned with Zakir Hussain that he taught you things, that not just music, but also behavior. Were they things about respect or the tradition?
No, respect, of course, respect is one thing. Respect, you don't need to be taught. I mean, it is inbuilt. I mean, you just observe and you learn how to do that. Otherwise, you're a stupid person. But I think Zakir Bhai is a very, very, very practical person. So now this is the problem. This is a situation that has arisen. How can I go ahead? How can I keep it aside and go ahead? That kind of thing, I learned a lot from Zakir Bhai. He is really a master of... I'll tell you a very small incident. In 1992, my Guruji, Pandit Hariprasad ji, had organized a very big all-night classical festival. And some of the biggest artists were performing there. Zakir Bhai had come there, but he was not performing. He had a very, like, you know, midnight flight or something was there. So he was not performing that year. Previous year, he had performed there. And suddenly in the month of December or January, it was in Bombay, open air, very big ground, and thousands of people were there. And suddenly, slight rain started, very untimely rain. Not very heavy showers, not like monsoon showers of Bombay. Monsoon showers of Bombay are like really, really crazily heavy. If you are outside, within like 3 seconds, you will be completely drenched. In Pune, within maybe 3 minutes, 5 minutes also, the rain will start very slowly, very small, tiny droplets. And then eventually it will become bigger. In Bombay, it's not. It just hits you. Like really, it's the drop, raindrop size is big and it hits you. But that day, it was untimely rain. So that was a kind of subtle drizzle. Suddenly, people were kept sitting because that was not so heavy. But the sound engineers got alert. They immediately covered the sound mixer with some big plastic. They already had somewhere because they had an idea it could rain. So they were prepared. So they covered the sound desk with a big piece of plastic. Somebody climbed up on the... There were huge speakers. So they covered the speakers. Amplifiers they covered and all that. And suddenly, we were just standing there, like, you know, looking at what was happening. And suddenly, I saw Zakir Bhai walking in, and he told the sound guys, okay, get somewhere a fan from somewhere and point it to the amplifiers because they will create a lot of heat. So this is not a musician's job. This is like beyond that. This is a technical. So these kind of things. So the kind of you think ahead what is going to happen. Whereas my Guruji was busy, if the rain is there, that what are we going to do with the so many people, and like all that. Thankfully, the rain stopped in like 5 minutes, and again, I mean, no, the concert didn't even stop. It just carried on for just a tiny drizzle. But that's like, you know, it happened in 92, and I still remember it after so many years. That even the sound technicians, they didn't realize that the amplifiers for the speakers will be generating a lot of heat, so you have to put some fans on that. So these kind of things, by observation, by talking, asking, these kind of things, I got to learn from him a lot. That's why it's like very, very practical, mm-hmm. and very, like, you know, his analysis mm-hmm. is very fast.
So you've written a lot of music for film?
Yes, some, not a lot.
Okay,
some.
That's part of what you've done. Do you record, like, how, since, are you writing any of it down, or is it all like you just playing or using synthesizer?
Initially, I would write down in notation, Indian notation. I have my own method of script. Like staff notation is there, and our Saregama is there. So I have combined both to an extent that I love the entire idea of ornamentation in the Western staff writing. All sort of trills and, like, you know, TPPP and FFF and this and all that kind of thing, all these different ornamentations, they are already clearly marked. In Indian traditional methods, they are not there. It's just written the ta-ta-ta-ta-ta, so ta-ta-ta-ta, that, you know, how that's crotchets and quavers and all that. But we just want, so what we do is, like, we write saga pa madha. So we'll just write, we'll mark that bars, and bars are, as you know, how it's exactly like the staff thing, that whatever the bar is, like, it is divided in, equally in like 4, 5, 3, 7, whatever that higher like, whatever, not denominator, whatever is the number called, I don't know. Instead of that, writing that signature like 6-8 or 12-8 or 3-4 or whatever, we don't write it. We just write the name of the taal. Because taal that way is more important to us than actually. And then we will do this all the same. So I have combined that, some of these two things. I used to do it initially a lot, but nowadays, because of we have these recording systems and all that, I'll just play the piece or play it on keyboard and input it in the I use Cubase, so I'll put it on Cubase. And when I go to the studio, there is a sitar there or something, I say, okay, this is the piece and you have to play it. More or less, so I don't, like, my writing abilities are kind of disappeared now. So I mean, I'll be able to read it, but I'm completely not in practice now. I studied staff notation for a while. There is a lovely book. I don't know unfortunately, the author of it. It's called as Rudiments of Music. It's a fantastic book for staff notation. So I studied from that, but that was like 30 years ago, maybe 20, 25 years ago. So, and one day I realized that staff notation, you have to read it. You have to be in touch with it every day. Only then you can read it. It's like that. Otherwise, it's very difficult.
Yeah, I mean, it's different parts of our brain. And you were mentioning, you know, the same as Western classical music, but of course it's different. Like you said, when you're really good, you can play anything you hear. Well, those of us from my tradition, we can't generally do that. We're so wedded to the page. We're so used to being able to read everything. It's not that we can't play something back that we've heard, but it's a lot harder.
Yeah.
Because you're, you know, I just think our brains develop differently. So I really admire that you could hear a melody on your trip, this complicated melody, and remember it. It's amazing.
Kind of, as you said, like, you know, playing as accurate you can play is going to be very difficult for us. Because you're trained in playing 100% accurate, mm-hmm. where we are not. We are more driven towards creative side of, like, okay, you create your, even my students, I mean, I kind of push them to create compositions, create their own melodies, and all that kind of things. Then to play 100% accurate. 100% playing, 100% accurate is needed for the sessions artists who are playing for films and all that kind of thing. Otherwise, it's not so much needed. I mean, it's not that you can go off somewhere and play anything, but the level of accuracy or precision Western classical musicians have is the highest and the greatest in the world. There is no doubt about it. I mean, there is just no doubt about it. I mean, I have some discussions. I said, no sportsman is, accurate. His level of accuracy is very, very below acceptance levels. Whereas I said, musicians are far, far superiorly accurate. Like, for example, the greatest of the tennis players, like any of these, Nadal or Federer or Djokovic or Ivanisevic, who was known for his aces, they cannot put all four aces. It's just not possible. Whatever the reasons may be. Whatever there may be wind or this or that. But all the musicians who are practicing in Western classical music, all orchestras and all the towns are playing, whatever they are playing is 100% accurate. Right? Then probably the difference is the emotional value that some bigger orchestras, better orchestras will have better emotional value or whatever. I mean, those parameters are different. Whatever they are playing is still correct. They are 100% accurate. There is no two-way about it.
So you did a really big tour back in 2013, like 7 months or something all around the world.
Oh, yeah. Well, that was fun. I was in Europe, I was in Canada, I was in America. I went to Korea, I went to Malaysia, Thailand, and came back. So not too many countries, but just around the world.
Yeah. Did you collaborate with local musicians everywhere you went?
Quite a lot. Practically everywhere. Because I didn't have my own team with me. So I would send some of my compositions, recordings to the local musicians and we would perform together. They would send some music to me. And just the head, I need to know what exactly. And otherwise, sometimes it was completely spontaneous on the spot also. Okay, you just start, I will join you. Then I would find which key he's playing and which changes. And okay. So then I would stick to one segment or whatever is very difficult, I won't play. And just skip that part with something and or just play very slow or something and just again. So whatever, I mean, that every music piece is different.
You had mentioned to me at a certain point you lived in Canada for a little while. Was it in the Toronto area?
Mississauga. My wife was working there and I visited her quite often when I stayed at a stretch in Mississauga and I played there a lot. Canada has some lovely musicians.
Yeah, there's quite a large Indian community there. I was curious, what were your impressions coming from India of, that community?
Oh, Indian community? Well, I played some with local Western musicians also. I played in Markham Jazz Festival and at Beaches Jazz Festival. I just, as a part of some band, I played there. But in Indian society, I think Indian society in Canada is, especially in Toronto, is really fantastic in terms of music. Otherwise, I mean, whatever is, every society is there. There was a tabla player called as Mohan Singh, Pandit Mohan Singh. Very sadly, he died a few years ago. I think he had cancer and he got cured. Then he gave a big fight, but unfortunately, he died. He was a great man and great musician, phenomenal tabla player. And he had a big, large room, and several tabla pairs would be there. And every Friday or Thursday, I think Friday evening, a lot of tabla students would come to his place from nearby, some from little far away. And not from the same gharana. Somebody is learning with this guru, somebody is learning in that with that guru, somebody is learning something different guru, and there are different mixed traditions there, and everybody would come together and practice for 4 hours, 3 hours, 5 hours, 6 hours, and till, like, you know, they would start in the evening and go till the late in the night. And I went there. I also played with these guys, and eventually I played in his house, and we became very good friends. I feel very sad that he is no more with us. He was a very strong supporter of Indian classical music. He himself played tabla, and some of his students are doing very well now. So Indian society, Indian community in Toronto is very strongly attached with music. There are lot of really good musicians living in Indian musicians living in Toronto area, I mean, ETA, whatever, Greater Toronto area, I think we call it. Very, very good musicians. So performing in front of them was kind of challenging, and the audience also is really fantastic over there. The listeners, they understand the music, and I tell you, this Mohanji, Mohan Singh asked me that, will you play at my place? I said, like, yeah, whenever you tell me. And he fixed one of my concerts. There was tabla. There was a very, very fantastic good tabla there called as Shubhajyoti Guha. He comes from Calcutta, but he also lives in Toronto. I think he lives in somewhere that was the east part of Toronto. I don't know. So I asked him, how long should I play? Like, you know, 1 hour, 1.5 hours, 2 hours. So I said, like, whatever you will play, we will listen. We have come here to listen to you. So I said, yeah, but give me some rough idea. He said, like, no, Milinji, you play. If you want to play 20 minutes and stop, we are okay with that. If you want to play till morning, yeah, still we will keep sitting. And literally, I started playing at 9:30 or 10 or something. And first break, I took around midnight. Then I was like, they were really, really very, very, the entire audience was, I would say 50% audience was musicians. Some was learning sitar, some was learning tabla, some was somewhere learning Israj, all sorts of, some singers and all, everybody had come there, because Mohanji's home concerts were really, really a prestigious thing, I believe. Because he was a musician, so he had invited a lot of musicians. And the first break I took around midnight, and then I told him, Mohanji, I'm very hungry, give me something sweet to eat. So he being a Sardarji, sick, his wife had made some very traditional Indian sweets. So I hogged that, and then I thought that, okay, I'll play for another hour and stop. I that time I started playing Rag Malkamos. It's a midnight rag. And generally, I am very good with time. Without looking at my watch, I can actually understand how much time I have played. So you just tell me, okay, play 45 minutes. I will stop anywhere between 44 minutes to 45 minutes. I'm that good. That was one day I kind of lost the track of time. And I thought that I'll play Rag Malkamos for about 20 to 25 minutes, maybe half an hour. And then I'll play a dhun and end the concert, because I had another concert next day also. It was a Saturday night. I took the second break at 2 at night. Everybody was sitting, we were just playing, and then I said, oh, it is 2 o'clock. So then I played for another, like, maybe 1 hour or something, and then I said, okay, now I have to stop. So that, like, you know, that, and all audience, not even one person left. Everybody was sitting there. That's amazing. I mean, even in India, it is not so easy to find that this kind of audience now. It was that was one concert I'll never forget.
That's an amazing story, Milind. So when you play, it's very meditative for you. So do you meditate aside from music, or is it enough just to play the flute?
I did that, but I'm not too successful in that. My meditation is my music, I think, because some of the spiritual masters also have noticed that. But I actually asked one very, very big, very deep spiritual master called as Sai Kaka. Whenever I try to meditate, it becomes a little difficult for me. They said, like, why are you doing that? Don't worry, your music is your meditation. So I kind of took it at its stride, and I focus on music now. But yes, like whatever the, you know, I'm supposed to achieve with meditation, I think I achieve with my music, mm-hmm. whatever the peace of mind, whatever. I've been connected with Osho, Rajneesh for quite some time. But again, my focus is towards the music more than different, because he has taught some 101 types of different meditations and all that. Instead of trying to do all these 101 type of musicians, I prefer to pick up my flute and play that. I mean, I'll tell you one thing, that you must have heard this meditation, very like, you know, a popular meditation called Vipassana or Vipassana. So what we do is, like, what you are supposed to do is, like, focus on the breathing at the tip of our nose and try to forget, like, you know, get rid of thoughts in your mind. And that's what we do in flute. When you are playing flute, we have to focus on the music so that we will know that we are, whether we are in tune or not. So that kind of, it's that way, I think it's very close to meditation anyway.
You mentioned Osho.
Yeah, of course.
There's still an ashram there in Pune. Did you meet him?
Unfortunately, no. I went to Osho commune on his Osho's birthday when my Guruji was playing there. But unfortunately, it was his last birthday, so he was not very well. Physically, was not very. He died within one and a half months. He died. So unfortunately, I never saw Osho, but. Since then I have been there. So it was like my one guru took me to other guru, spiritual guru kind of. But I have played in Osho a lot.
No, I was wondering, I'm going to be speaking very soon with an Australian musician.
Oh, nice.
And she was a follower of his and lived at the commune in the States. So we were, yeah, when I spoke, yeah.
Yeah,
she said, mentioned he really loved music, and she mentioned your guru, that he had come there to the States to play there. So there was that connection. So to end this conversation, I just wanted to ask you a little bit about your teaching, and then I was hoping you could play one last piece of music for us. But in terms of your teaching, just the kinds of things you find are most important to teach your students that work with you.
So let me explain a bit about the education method in India, traditional education method in India. Which is still followed in the music for sure. And some other art forms like spirituality and all this meditation journey. It is called as Guru Shishya Parampara. That means Guru, Shishya is the student, teacher, master and the student, tradition. So in the European or probably British, I'm not sure, I'm not a student of history anyway. But in the European method of teaching, standard teaching, like which is followed in all schools in India now, or probably all over the world, that we gather all the kids of the same age, put them in one class. All guys who are born in whatever one year, 1970, they will be in same class. Few months here and there. And then we teach them, all of them, whatever 20, 30, 50 students, 10, whatever the number of students you have gathered, the same thing. Irrespective of whether the child has that aptitude whether the child has inclination to learn that, we don't care. We just teach him that. And the life goes on. It has created some very good results, this method. I mean, all of us, all scientists have gone through the same channel of studying. So that has its own merits and its own advantages. But also it has some disadvantages, I'm sure. What happens in Guru Shishya Parampara, it is more one-to-one teaching. So every student, like some time ago, I gave an example that three very good students of a teacher will find a rhythm is like part more exciting. One will find the deep meditative side of the music exciting. Third will find balance thing more exciting. He will say, okay, I want to walk on this way. So the guru will teach the student whatever he requires the most. The guru will understand the journey of a student, which direction this student can go, which direction he will progress better. Whether he wants to do it or not is not the best in the question. Because especially with the young kids, what they want to do, what they want, keeps changing from 6 months. Time to time. So somebody wants to become the railway engine driver. 6 months down the later, he might become want to become a tennis player. Another 1 year, that child might want to become an astronaut. And all, you know how it is. So the guru will understand probably, okay, he has better aptitude in this. This guy has better aptitude, better inclination towards this. So I'll tell you, if with my students, I have several students. I don't have my academy as such because I don't have that kind of time. Because according to me, if I say yes to any student, it is a long-term responsibility for me. And so I don't have, right now, I think I have only 5 students or 6 students. And I generally take some basic like level of students. I mean, I don't take so basic that he doesn't know how to hold flute and all that. I just actually did a video course for a website called as livedemy.com, LIVDEMY. It's like Udemy, but only for Indian music, Indian Bollywood, in classical. So I just shot and recorded 2 courses of very basic of flute, like how to fold a flute, how to blow the flute, what is flute, and all that kind of things. That should get uploaded in some time now, this month now. So I take little advanced students, not very basic, intermediate students, I would say. And there also, I know whatever the 5-6 students are there, so I will, I have like one, since this year, last year, 2022, I started a group practice session every Sunday morning. But till then, I would invite everybody individually. Like maximum number of students I would have at one time where it was 2. But that also was not really that was also very rare. Mm-hmm. So now whoever students are studying with me, I know their weaknesses. I know their strengths. I know their inclination. And I also know the kind of support they are getting from their parents, or they are not getting any supports. Are they on their own? Or a couple of guys are very, very well supported with their families. The families are very much interested there that they are playing flute and all that. A couple of students are on their own. They're slightly older, maybe like 20 or something, 22 or something. So they are on their own. So they pursue music on their own like I did. I mean, I didn't have too much. There's no support from my parents and family anyway. My family all comes from business side, so they were not interested. So that way I teach them. But the thing is that I don't take 40 students, 100 students, that kind of thing. I don't think I have had 40 students in my entire life. But my couple of students, like 3 students of mine, have their own classes. They have their own academies. So if it's some very basic student comes, I send to one of those.
Okay. Well, would you be willing to play a little bit more music before the end?
Oh yeah, sure. What should I play? I'll play some classical, and I have not played classical. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Wow. Thank you so much, Milind. I really love your playing and I've been enjoying your album. So of course your website will be linked in the description so people can.
It was nice talking to you. Really nice talking to you. Talking to a musician.
Well, thanks. Always... thanks for being part of this.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you.
I hope you enjoyed this week's episode. Thanks for following the series on your favorite podcast player and sharing your favorite episodes with your friends, all of which help find new listeners. I have lots more episodes coming in this season 3 with a fascinating diversity of musicians and their stories and music. Have a great week.